Okay, so we're looking at Psalm 74 today, and the title in the sort of the planner says despair. And certainly there's a psalm that's full of sort of dark colors, isn't there? It's not a fun psalm. It's one of the more difficult psalms, but I'm not sure. Okay, it's come out now, hasn't it? It has come up, yeah. It's not necessarily about personal despair, which is sometimes what we think of in terms of the Bible in Psalms in particular. We think about, you know, I'm in a terrible position, you know, I cried from the depths, I called to you. And it's not that sort of personal despair. Something else seems to be going on in this psalm. And as I was looking at it, it's quite a difficult psalm to get into. I remembered something that happened, I guess, almost 40 years ago. My parents bought me an electronics kit, I think for Christmas or for my birthday, I can't remember which. And one of the things about this particular electronics kit was that it had loose resistors and transistors and things. And these all looked the same, little blobs with a couple of wires coming out of each end. And there were some sort of lines on each one, pretty lines, reds and browns and violet, green, sometimes some yellow. And I sort of just looked at these, and what I should have done and didn't do, was work out what the lines meant, because they were a code that showed me that although these things all looked the same, they were actually very different. And I didn't bother about which was which, and I just sort of shoved them in and made the circuits up, and none of my circuits ever worked. And it occurs to me that we do the same sort of things with psalms, really, don't we? We say, well, here's a psalm, I'll just read it. I'm not feeling particularly good, or I'm struggling here, I'll just read this psalm. And of course, if you want to make the psalms work for you, you have to understand a little bit about the code that's on them. It will cheer you up to know that even 8 years later, when I went to university to do electronics, I still managed to bad fail my first class test. And in fact, as the lecturer was going through, I may have told this before, I can't remember, as the lecturer was going through the things, he made a joke about one of the answers, somebody was so stupid, and I realized it was me as I was sitting at the back, that was my contribution to the class test. So eventually I had to get down and learn what these codes meant. And if you want to really make the Bible work for you at some stage, you have to do a little bit of working out about the structure of the Psalms and what they're saying. And as I say, this is quite a difficult one to get into. The first three verses, the commentary I have on Psalms is quite a recent one and quite a helpful one. And something that the chap suggests is that the first three verses, actually, they serve as an introduction in a very special way, because there's an introduction and then there's three other passages. And one of the passages we spent some time on this morning, the bit about creation, about day and night. The day is yours, the night also is yours. And what the commentator says is actually verse 1 relates to the next section along, to section 2, if you like, which is verses 4 to 11. The verse 2 is a sort of a little introduction that talks about what's going to happen in the section that we've spent a little bit of time on, verses 12 to 17, the third section. And then the last section is sort of highlighted in the introduction by verse 3. And so if you want to go away and spend some time with the psalm, you can sort of look at the different sections and see the way in which the introduction provides you with a sort of a succinct summary of what's going to happen next. One of the things I'm trying to do at the moment is to read a book a week. And at the moment, I'm cheating a little bit because I'm just finishing off books that I haven't done necessarily. But I'm ahead of schedule at the moment. And one of the books that John told me I needed to read was something he'd come across called Preaching Jesus Christ Today. And so I download all these on my Kindle, and then I try and find ones that I haven't read and sort of catch up with them. But this is written by somebody called Annette Brownlee. And she sets up six questions for every sermon to follow. That's a little bit structured for me. I like some questions. I don't necessarily like six every time. But I thought I'd give it a go this morning and see, well, what does Annette's idea about preaching have to do to help us as we look at this passage? And one of the first questions she asked is, what do I see? And we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at the first section, and we're going to use that question as our way in. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time on section 2 and see what that says to us. And then we'll spend some time just summarizing what happens in section 3, which we've already spent a little bit of time on in worship, and then in section 4. And then we're going to say, well, is that all? We've done the psalm now. Is that all? And Annette has got some other questions, and we're going to take two of her questions. And one of them is about where we see Jesus in all this. Where is Christ in all this? I can't even read those things. Either my eyes are going terribly wrong, which is Gillian's fault if I can't see anything. But I don't think it is. I think probably I've chosen too small a thing. Too small, right? The font is too small. Okay. The second question in her list is the what we're going to come back to, which is where is Christ in that? But what does the words up there actually say?
Whom do I see?
Right. And the whom do I see is it takes me back sort of to my very early time as a Christian, where the people I sort of worshipped with were very keen in seeing Jesus in absolutely everything. So all the way through the New Testament, they would see types of Jesus. And it's been interesting to go back from a very different perspective and say, whom do I see? And then what is Christ's word to us? What's God got to say to us through Jesus in this passage? And you say, well, Jesus hasn't been born yet. But that doesn't matter, because the Holy Spirit, who sort of inspired it all, was alive and well and working on planet Earth when this was written. So, silence and the signs. That's the second section after the introduction. The introduction says, why has God discarded us? Why does your anger smolder against the sheep of your pasture? Why have you rejected us? And perhaps even in that picture is the sort of the scene of some sheep scattered across a hillside, and behind them the city where the shepherds might have lived, or where their families would have lived perhaps, going up in smoke because somebody has come in and destroyed the place. And the second section is about destruction and desolation and desecration everywhere. So the first thing in verse 4 is about the way that people have come into the place. If you've not got a Bible, just wave your arms and somebody will probably bring one up. Maybe Sharon or Ewan will grab one for you. The numbers of the pages, we're on page 588 at the moment. But do get yourselves a pew Bible or ask for one and somebody will bring one up. Verses 4 and forward says, they behaved like men wielding axes to cut through a thicket of trees. They smashed the carved paneling with their axes and hatchets. They burned your sanctuary to the ground. And so this person is looking on, and the sense of sort of desolation that we pick up and that we first label despair is because of what the person sees happening to the temple of God. And for that reason, it's quite difficult to actually place when this psalm was written. There may have been more than one occasion, and it's hard to actually nail down exactly when the psalm was written. But somebody has seen foreign troops come in and destroy the temple. And it's not just destruction, it's furious stuff. It's taking things that you would use to cut wood in a forest, and they're using it to cut down highly carved, beautiful stuff inside a holy place. And we see that on the news, don't we? We see antiquities being destroyed in certain parts of the world. It's a picture that's not that different even today. And the second thing that the psalm writer sees is they see foreign symbols going up. Now, it's not clear exactly what these symbols are. They may have been the sort of the military standards. People come up and they plant their military standard. The Romans, remember, they had a standard with SPQR, and wherever the Roman armies went, they put that standard, and that says, this is Roman territory now. And perhaps it was that had gone in. Perhaps it was flags of something. But the symbols that had shown that this was a holy place have been displaced and taken down in a completely savage way. And we probably don't see that in our own church. In our own church, we do see symbols. It wouldn't take you that long, I don't suppose, to work out that this might be a place of worship. The flags up above, they sort of say, well, what sort of a place of worship is this? What are those symbols telling us about the mix of people that worship here? I think probably the only sort of really secular symbol is the no smoking sign, which you have to have everywhere, which is completely stupid in this place because I don't think anybody smokes in church anyway. But nonetheless, we have to have a symbol somewhere where the government says we're in charge and we don't want bad things to happen, so you must put up a no smoking sign. So there will be one somewhere inside the church. So there are some, but by and large, the symbology around us, it's not deep symbology. We don't have icons, but we do have things that show that this is a church. And while I was preparing, I emailed a friend of mine who's into Old Testament Hebrew at Cambridge, and he sent me some of his stuff, and that was helpful. And then he sent me a little note, just an email, as he was sort of signing off. And he said that Dietrich Bonhoeffer had written one of the verses here that was in one of the verses here in his prayer book, and it said, "We are given no signs from God, no prophets are left, none of us knows how long this will be." What he'd written down there was that we have lost our emblems. And he'd written that on the night, it's got there the 8th and 9th of November 1938, I think it might have been the 9th and 10th overnight, when Nazi paramilitary storm troopers came and they destroyed a lot of Jewish property in Berlin. And they smashed synagogues and they smashed shop fronts and they destroyed businesses that were associated with the Jewish population. That's in 1938. And there was so much glass in the streets that the night came to be known as Kristallnacht or Kristallnacht. And on that night, when he sort of heard about or even, maybe even saw, I don't know where he was at this time, he wrote that in his own prayer diary, "Our emblems have gone and we don't hear a word from a prophet anymore." And it's because of that that the psalmist is distraught. It's not just that the sound is over, the crashing of glass is finished, the hammer of hatchets is over, the sound of the wood paneling being destroyed, that's all gone. And there's silence, and still God says nothing. And the person is waiting to find out, when is God going to do something? He sees that the fires of destruction are extinguishing the flames of worship. Will anybody be able to worship anymore? And there's a strange phrase there, and again, people are really struggling to work out exactly what it means. Something about take your hand out. And I think basically what he's saying is take your hands out of your pockets and do something, God. Just do something because of the destruction. And that's one of the verses. That's one of the sections of this psalm. The second psalm talks about memory. And the psalm is talking about his own memory, the things that he can remember about God. And that's the way that the psalms often go when they describe the problem, they say how terrible things are, and then they start to remember. "It was you who split open the sea by your power," thinking about the way that God had delivered the nation, and also finding refuge in God's power as day follows night. The patterns of creation, the everyday patterns that remind the psalmist about God's acts of power. And so one of the things that you might like to take away is to actually spend a bit more time in that part of the psalm, thinking, you know, I don't know what it is that's disturbing you at the moment, but certainly that pattern about getting into thinking about the things that God has done is an important thing for you to remember and for me to remember. And certainly during the while we had the sort of the prayer time on the first of the month, when Danny and I spent some time praying together, one of the things that was really encouraging was to remember all of the good things that have happened in this church as we think about sort of some of the difficulties that we face, to remember the fact that God has been good to us, and there have been lots of good things for us, for our kids particularly. This has been a great place for our kids to grow up in. You may not feel that way yourselves, but we certainly feel that it's been a great place for them to have grown up in, and we see them sort of taking a heritage from that. So it's great to think about the things that God has done in the past. And we tend to think that memory is a very sort of passive thing. You know, I've got these memories, I can't get rid of my memories. And that's not really a biblical way of thinking about memory. Memory in the Bible is very much about what we choose to remember, and indeed, as we'll see in a minute, what we choose to forget. We're not just victims of our past. And the psalmist so often chooses to move from thinking about things that are bad to thinking about things that God has done that are really good. And it's an important thing to be able to do. Somebody else told me I needed to read another book called On Being a Servant of God. And the great thing is, you know, if you're doing a book a week, you can think, well, it's only a couple of weeks and I can get through that one and add that to the list as well. And it's quite a short book, this one. It was a bit disappointing to begin with, but it got better. A guy called Warren Wiersbe, who's quite well known, and for that reason, I hadn't read much of his stuff, and it was the first third of it's quite... if you're going to read, buy the book and read it, start around about chapter page 50, something like that. And the second half really gets very, very good indeed. But he tells a story about a guy called Sangster, and Sangster was a famous Methodist preacher. I think he was in the 19th century. And if you've not read his books, The Craft of the Sermon, if you're interested in talking and speaking and stuff like that, his books are really good. Even now, there's lots of really good stuff in there. But anyway, somebody saw him writing his Christmas list once, somebody who either looked after him or was looking after the house, and saw his list, and he saw somebody's name on that really surprised him, that Sangster that would be writing a Christmas card to this person. And he said, "Why are you sending a Christmas card to that person?" And he said, "Well, why wouldn't I send it?" And he said, well, this person did this. And he went through something that this person had done to Sangster that was really very unpleasant. And he used a phrase, which is why it was easy to Google it, especially being on Kindle. I could just sort of control F and get a hold of it. And Sangster said, "It was a thing I would remember to forget." Isn't that wonderful? You know, there are some things that we need to remember to forget. There are things that it's important to remember and that we should choose to remember. And there are times when there are things that we should remember to forget. And that second stanza of the psalm is about mixing the things that we need to remember and really using our minds and our memories in a very purposeful way. The last thing, bit of the chapter is about the sanctuary, God's sanctuary. The enemy has destroyed the sanctuary, is what it says in the introduction. And in the fourth section, the psalmist says, "God, remember that your enemy is my enemy. My enemy is your enemy. The people who have come in and done this terrible thing, they are out there. And you need to do something eventually about them." That's stuff for you to take away, particularly the second two stanzas. We've sort of worked them over just very, very briefly. But there's a huge amount in this psalm of great encouragement, particularly if you're distraught or desolate at the moment. Let's pick up this question, whom do I see? And this turned out to be a much more fruitful question than you might at first think because of the word for dwelling place. The dwelling place of your name, it talks about in verse 7. They burned your sanctuary to the ground. They defiled the dwelling place of your name. And if you use something like Bible Hub, you'll see that the word that they use there is the same word that's used for a tent. It's used to describe the tabernacle. When God told his people, "I want you to make me a portable place of worship," the tabernacle was the tent. And it's this same dwelling place word that is used there. And it's also used, surprisingly, of the temple. God's temple is God's dwelling place. And at Christmas time, we read a passage from the start of John's Gospel. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. That's on page 1063 if you're reading a pew Bible. God says, John tells us that the Word, God the Word, became flesh and made his dwelling place among us. And when the Jewish scholars came to translate the Old Testament psalm into Greek so they could have a translation that anybody anywhere in the world could read, they used the same Greek word that is used here in John. It's the same root for dwelling place. If you like, John is saying the Word became flesh and came camping among us. And so the sanctuary in the Old Testament, which was wood-paneled and dark and kept very private, that's become a person for us. That God has become a sanctuary and has come to live among us. And the New Testament picks that up in a big way, not just because Jesus is the dwelling place of God, but because by faith, and it's all there in John 1, by faith we can inherit that position ourselves. What is Christ's word for us? Well, if we look through some of the New Testament letters, we see what Paul does with this teaching. He said, we know that if our earthly tent, and it's that same tenting word that was used back in our psalm about the holy place, the sanctuary, we know that if our earthly tent, and he's talking about our bodies, we have is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. And so he said, actually, for each one of us, the dwelling place of God is not wood paneled anymore, and it's not just one person who lives one place on earth and died and rose again. He said, actually, the dwelling place of God is skin colored all over the world. And at the end, in the end of all time, when John again catches a sight of things too beautiful really to write down, he said, I heard a loud voice, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people. And the story that starts in a garden and finishes in a city is all about God finding a place to dwell and to live among people. And our psalmist is distraught because God cannot dwell or doesn't seem to be dwelling amongst his people anymore. And so one of the messages for us to take away is to remind ourselves that the dwelling place of God is inside us. If you're a Christian, if you've committed your life to Jesus, if you are expecting the Holy Spirit to work and live in you and to live out through you in your life, then your mind, your body, is the dwelling place of God. Do you not know, says Paul, that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who's in you, whom you have received from God? And what's the message from that to be? Well, he says, don't be conformed in Romans chapter 12. That's on page 1139. He says, do not conform to the pattern of this world. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And so what was a sort of a passive space that enemy soldiers could come in and trash is actually a very personal, a very dark space. It's very dark inside your skull. No light gets in there at all. If light starts to get in there, you're in trouble. But nonetheless, although it's a very private place, it's a place where God is active. And what the message, Christ's word to us, what's that enduring word that comes to us? It says, make sure that place is really sacred. There are so many different distractions and other things that can come in and can take our minds away. And each of us will have different distractions that are different. For some of us, it'll be the things we watch on telly, maybe. For others of us, it'll be the things we worry about. For others of us, it'll be things that we come across in our daily working life. It'll be temptations to do things to make our life perhaps easier. All kinds of different things are going on. And Paul says, don't conform. Be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind. And one of the books that sort of is probably most dedicated to that was written a long time ago. It was written in the 1600s. That was the 17th century, wasn't it? By John Bunyan. And he's famous for writing Pilgrim's Progress. But he also wrote a book called The Holy War. And I read a modern translation of it, sometimes the English that John Bunyan wrote 400 years ago or so is a little bit tricky. But certainly you can get up-to-date translations of it. And I had to refresh my mind as to what was in it by good old Wikipedia, which will give you a quick summary of what's going on in there. But there's actually, it's an allegory, and it's a sustained allegory. It's a slightly strange way of writing, and it takes a little bit of getting used to. You probably have to read to at least page 50 before you can get into it and really understand what's going on there. But it's a great way of looking at the way in which the enemy takes control of a city and somebody else comes to save the city. And the names of the people make it quite clear who's who. It's not a very difficult code to crack. And there's an eye gate, and there's an ear gate, and there's various other ways that the messages get in and propagate around this city. So, our summary is that Psalm 74 is a lament. We don't have many laments, but it's a lament for something that the psalmist sees happening. The psalmist is not distraught primarily on his own behalf, but is distraught by what has happened to God's city, and particularly to the temple. And we've explored it as a sort of a structural piece of writing with an introduction that helps us to understand the rest. And we've left some homework to be taken away. And you might like to use verse 2 to open up the second section, and verse 3 to open up the last section. And we've seen that actually those questions, whom do I see, and what is Christ's word to me, actually they can be used in the context of a psalm like this. We can see that actually in this idea of the dwelling place, there is a very strong link to the whole of the New Testament messages about Jesus as the embodiment of God, and then the greater truth for us that is not just that Jesus came and he was out there, but that he comes and is part of us and saves our lives. And we've also seen how, if that's true, it means that the sanctuary that was destroyed by foreign armies and by destructive people with axes and fire and everything else, that's still vulnerable in our day and age. And our responsibility is to look after that and to watch out for the way that we do things. Andy, thanks very much indeed. Thank you.